Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Phil Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And our special guest today is William Henry. William, welcome to the show.
Great to talk with you guys. Thank you for having me.
Now, we both, Kathleen and I, have been on your show, and it's a great pleasure to actually welcome you on our show as well. And for those of you, William, who do not know you, how would you introduce yourself?
I am an author and an investigator of ancient mysteries. I gave myself a title, investigative mythologist, which is sort of like being an investigative journalist, except I focused on mythology and ancient stories and how these ancient myths, symbols, and stories are replaying themselves in ways in the modern era.
I want to talk about that for a second, because one of the reasons I was very excited to finally have you on the show is so there's something that I wanted to say to you for a long time, and I wanted to give you props for the amount of field work that you do. There are a lot of people who are immersed in this world of esoterica and truth-seeking, and a lot of them work very hard from their armchairs. A lot of them do a lot of work on Google, and... You know, there are really not as many who are doing what you do. I think that one of the things that is really exciting and unique about your work and the way you do it is you're a real field guy. You are out in the middle of everything. You get your hands dirty. You go on site. And I think that that's why your work stands out and has a richness to it and a depth that you don't see everywhere else. And so that's something I've wanted to say to you for a long time. I really wanted to commend you for that, because I find that very exciting about your work.
Well, thank you, Kathleen, very much. I really appreciate that. And my audiences always can tell the difference when I show a photograph in my presentation that I've taken versus one that might come off Google or something. And you're right, it does make a difference. I can cite numerous examples. There was a guy recently who borrowed quite a bit of my research on the United States Capitol, and I had spent a lot of time and a lot of money going to the Capitol, getting in there and working it out, and he got my research wrong. And that always makes me cringe, because you're right, there's too many guys that and gals too that do the armchair research, and there is no substitute for actually going to a place and verifying a fact for yourself, experiencing it for yourself, and then being able to share with an audience your perspective on that based on the fact. And I consider myself a service provider in that way. I am going out to these places on behalf of people and coming back and presenting what I discovered and trying to present it in the most factual way possible, so that the individual who's on the other end has an opportunity to fit it into their own research program, or perhaps to compare it with what they've already discovered on their own.
Well, and that's another thing that I really commend you for, and I feel very much the same way, in that I don't want to be precious about my research. I'm not going to say, oh, I did this and you can't use it. I do my work in the field the same way that you do, and I'm very happy to share it with the world and say, here, take what I have discovered and use it in your own. But to your point, you also want to make sure that people are quoting you accurately and using it accurately. I actually witnessed what happened with your research on the Capitol recently. I had seen this other author, if you will, use your work, and I'd also seen you have to come out and correct it. So we witnessed that, and I've seen that an awful lot. But again, you're very generous with your research and very generous about putting it out there. But I do think that there's always this issue of wanting to make sure that you're at least being quoted correctly.
Well, that's right, because again, time and time again, I can cite examples where it has gone out, someone has utilized the material, they don't source me, and what ultimately happens then is they deprive the audience of the ability to go back and check, verify, or further investigate on their own. And that's really why I am so adamant about asking people to, hey, use all you want, but if you wouldn't mind, just drop the source so that people know where it came from and can follow it up.
How do you respond to the academic criticism that I'm sure you have encountered in the same way that I have? The traditionalists, the historians, the biblical scholars, the people who say that what we do is not real research because we're not chained to their academic sources. Those academics who think that those of us who believe in the importance of folklore, culture, mythological sources, in my opinion, are the most important sources in getting to the truth. How do you respond to academic criticism?
Well, I just try to make sure that what I'm presenting has some kind of basis in fact. And again, one person's fact is another person's fallacy in a way. And so I just try to, A, provide the sources, button it down that way, and also recognize that your, as John Anthony West calls them, quackademics, almost always have an agenda. And so I try not to pay too much attention to it, to be perfectly honest with you. But I feel that the best thing you can do for individuals like that is use sources that they will actually recognize. And then what you're doing it from that point forward is just questioning one person's interpretation of those facts versus another's.
Well, let's back up a little bit, because I'd like to know more about how you ended up on this path. I mean, the name of the show is A Spirit Revolution, and we're always very excited to interview people who are doing spiritually revolutionary things, and you are certainly one of those. In fact, I would say you're a leader in the spirit revolution that's happening right now. How did you end up here? How did this start for you? I know you've been doing this kind of research for about 20 years. Mm-hmm. You and I have been on kind of an interesting parallel path for about the same amount of time. But I don't know anything about how you got started, and I think that that could be something very interesting for all of us to hear.
Well, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan. I moved to Nashville when I was 19. My father was in the record business, and I had plans to become an entertainment lawyer. Maybe work on Music Row here in Nashville, maybe come to Hollywood, I don't know. And here in Nashville, there's a college, Belmont University, that offers a degree program in entertainment law. And that was what I was going to do. But the catch was, this school was a Baptist college. And so what that meant is that you had to take Bible study classes. I didn't grow up in a particularly religious family, confirmed Episcopalian, went to church on Christmas and Easter, sat there wondering what I was doing there. And so here I am, a sophomore in a Bible study class. Our professor, this is 1982, our professor assigns us to review a book whose implications would impact Christianity. So I hiked it down to the bookstore, and I find this brand new book, hot off the presses, called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. I start flipping through it, and it says, as we all know, the crucifixion was a carefully scripted drama. There's a true religion of Jesus and Mary Magdalene as opposed to the descriptive religion about them. There's this mystery village in southern France where these secrets ultimately might be revealed. I was instantly hooked, and our assignment was to do a 3-page book review, 4 pages. I spent the entire semester doing nothing but reading that book, contemplating its ultimate possibilities, and was flunked by my professor, who sat me down after and said, "What are you doing here?" So my professor sits me down, and his question is, what are you doing here? Are you sure you want to go to college at a small Southern Baptist school?" And my ultimate answer was no, and I just set off on a course of self-study that has lasted to this very day. It ended up, during the interim, spent about half a dozen trips down to Rennes-le-Château pursuing this mystery, and it's still a constant source of inspiration to me. I had the pleasure, like many listeners, I'm sure, of finally meeting Henry Lincoln and interviewing Michael Bagent. So I'm one of the Holy Blood, Holy Grail guys, the fruits of that book. And, of course, we all know that it inspired Dan Brown. It caused this, or created this enormous revolution in thought that is still continuing to this day.
And then you became infatuated with Egypt in the middle of all this. Where did Egypt come in for you?
Egypt sort of was born out of, I had spent the early 90s following the trail of Zachariah Sitchin and the Anunnaki and all of that business. I got deeply interested in the subject of UFOs. And so that's when Egypt started to come into the picture. And I was particularly interested in some of the technological aspects of ancient Egypt. During the 90s, I had been doing quite a bit of research on the herald or forerunner of the Christ or Messiah, a figure that has a sort of a to-do list. This figure assembles what I refer to as a kit that includes the scepter that once belonged to Moses, the cruse of anointing oil, the Ark of the Covenant, the flask of manna, and so forth. And as I was researching that kit and seeing how it might actually be assembled, I'm led, of course, to ancient Egypt, knowing that Moses was trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and likely the Ark of the Covenant was a piece of Egyptian technology. So that started the whole Egypt quest for me, and I can tell you that I just barely have scratched the surface on the subject of ancient Egypt. It is so absolutely incredible, and to me is the ground zero for all the ancient mystery school teachings.
Well, and speaking of, you know, walking the walk and doing the work, you were in Egypt at the beginning of the revolution last year, correct?
We were. Yes, back in January and in early February. I had 24 people with me and suddenly found ourselves in the midst of a tremendous initiation. I like to say that in the ancient world, they supposedly used to put you in a pool full of crocodiles and you had to swim across to the other side. These days, all you do is you go to the Cairo airport in the middle of a revolution and try to survive it. And that's what we did. It was an extraordinary experience and one that I don't particularly want to repeat, but I know now for sure that we can get through something like that. And thanks to my wife Claire, we were able to get all 24 of our passengers home, and everybody has got a high story to tell.
That's fantastic. And you're going back to Egypt next February? Is that when you're going back?
Yes, we are. We're going back in February of 2012, the 14th through the 27th. It's an extraordinary time to be there. Egypt is just seeming to be so energetically alive right now. And in my view, it's going to be a very important place to be in 2012.
Well, we're going to give the information to our listeners later, but they'll be able to find all this information about the trips that you are hosting as well as your other work on your website, williamhenry.net. We will put that up later, but I did want to put that out there because sometimes people like to follow along a little bit. Speaking of williamhenry.net, first of all, it's beautiful. The website looks fantastic. It's really so nicely done. But it's like a candy store for me when I go on your website. There's all these – I'm so excited about all the articles, and I look through it, and I'm like, and I want to talk about this, and I want to talk about this. There's some really great information and really fun reading on there, so I will definitely be talking about williamhenry.net so that people can go and follow along. But, you know, the subject that is near and dear to my heart that doesn't surprise too many people is the subject of Mary Magdalene. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little late to the party here because I think you wrote this book in about 2006. Actually, I think you wrote about the same time that The Expected One came out. I think, once again, you and I have this sort of interesting parallel path in our work and our publishing. You wrote a book called The Illuminator about Mary Magdalene. And I want to get into some of the things that you talk about in that. But first, I'd just like you to talk a little bit about what Mary Magdalene means to you. I love the reverence that you treat her with in this book.
Well, thank you very much. Actually, yeah, The Illuminator was my 11th book. So I had spent a lot of time working in and around the whole Rennes-le-Château area. My book, Blue Apples, was about the what I call the Lost Stargate artifacts and spiritual teachings of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Wrote a book called The Language of the Birds about the language of alchemy. Crystal Halls of Christ Court was about the Cathars. Ark of the Christos was about that as well. So was Cloak of the Illuminati. So around the time of 2005, 2006, I was in a real sense kind of ready to do a book strictly focused on Mary Magdalene. As you recall, back then there was a lot of interest in the subject of the Magdalene. Da Vinci Code had inspired quite a bit of that interest. Lawrence Gardner was writing about Mary Magdalene, quite a few others, of course, Margaret Starbird, yourself. So I just decided that it was time to take a very focused look at Mary Magdalene, and I was inspired by the golden legend of Jacobus of Voragine, who referred to Mary Magdalene as the Illuminator, as the Illuminated One. And that really stuck with me. And so that became the impetus, really, for looking at Mary Magdalene as this great initiate. It was more than a throwaway line in my presentations when I would tell people that I believe that Mary Magdalene was the ringleader of the Jesus Revolution, that he was sort of like her daredevil test pilot. And she was the one with all the real, not the real knowledge, but without her, there is no way you have a Jesus revolution. And so I wanted to know, what was it that she brought to the table, and why was it so important for her to be singled out as his chief apostle, as his chief partner in this revolution?
Well, and you do a fine job of that. I have to commend you for doing something early on in this book, which was very brave, and I did a double take when I saw it. You do something that I think a lot of people think, a lot of people feel, but very few people voice. You call the Catholic Church a terrorist organization. And I was really struck by that. I thought, you know what? It takes a lot of spine to do what William does in this book, because you really call them out for what they did with the Cather genocide. So have you had to deal with any kind of backlash from the church for your point of view, by the way?
No, I actually have not. I know that I have drawn the eye of possibly the Vatican. Certainly, I've been told the Israelis were very interested in the work I was doing on manna and the Knights Templars and their let's call it their agricultural activities in the area around Rennes-le-Château. So I have had a couple of run-ins, but for the most part, I haven't showed up on their radar. And to a large extent, the people that I give presentations to and consider my readership are usually friendly people. They're not the ones that are out there, the hostiles that are wanting to stir up trouble for you.
Which is a good thing. So looking at the Illuminator, this book is so full of information. You've really packed a lot of different examples in here. It's excellent. And I have to tell you, I'm a tough sell on Magdalene books. And whereas I may not always go with you in certain places where you take your theories, I certainly will go with you with how much work you've done and how much research you have done on it. There's so much in this that to know where to start is a little bit difficult. But I think, you know, you write a lot about anointing and the importance of anointing beyond sort of the typical understanding of, you know, the anointing of the king, etc. You really get into this from a very physical and biological point of view as well. So I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about this importance of anointing as it pertains to Mary Magdalene and as it pertains to spirituality in general.
Well, yeah, and that's a wonderful question, and it's one that, again, I've spent a couple of decades trying to sort out, and I'm still in the process of doing so. I have an event coming up here in Nashville on September 9th through the 11th called The Anointed, which is continuing research on this subject. Where I guess I start with this is, first of all, the early Christian initiates were called Illuminati, and the reason they were called that is because they were awakened ones. They became illuminated ones. The symbol of their illumination was a candle, a lighted taper. As I'm thinking about that, I'm speculating here because I don't have these words written specifically in the Gospel of Mary Magdalene or in some of the other Nag Hammadi scrolls or any other place specifically, but I believe that they knew about our body. They knew about our chakra system. And when I'm thinking of them as offering a lighted candle as a symbol of illumination, I'm thinking, okay, they're talking about lighting up the chakras. They recognize that our spinal cord system is sort of akin to a candle. Our pineal gland is the wick. And the fundamental problem that all of us have is none of our candles are lit. None of our elevators go to the top. And to me, this is the fundamental question that they were trying to answer, and that was, how do we light our candles? How do we get our chakra systems to be fully functioning, which it then becomes the stairway to heaven? How do we ignite the latent capabilities of the pineal gland, this wonderful manufacturing plant of sacred oils? It contains these secretions that contain the secrets of how we transform ourselves into beings of light, which is actually, in my view, the ultimate question that the Jesus Revolution was all about. These guys, in my opinion, were highly trained esoteric initiates who scoured the ancient world, Egypt, Iran, Iraq, India, Mongolia, Tibet, looking for specific knowledge. And that specific knowledge was about, how do you resurrect a human being? How do you take us out of this mortal coil, out of this pupil form, this cocoon form, this caterpillar form, and metamorphose or morph us into our next phase of evolution, which is allegorically referred to as a butterfly, but which is called the light body, the rainbow body, the resurrection body. And this is what the anointing is all about, because if we can ignite this latent capability within us, if we can receive these higher vibrational energies coming from the cosmos that awaken the pineal gland, that is the process that kickstarts this ability we all have to resurrect ourselves, to transform into beings of light.
And you believe that Mary Magdalene was a master of this process?
I believe Mary Magdalene was a master of this process. She possessed this alchemical knowledge of how we transmute the human element from an impure being into a pure being. And this is why she is so important in the Jesus Revolution. When she shows up in Capernaum with this vital knowledge, when Jesus is being challenged by the elders and they say, look, you believe you're Moses? Let's have some of that manna. Let's have some of that star food, that cosmic food. She is the one that comes in with the connective knowledge that enables him to fulfill that and then takes it one step forward and anoints him and begins this process that results in his resurrection as a light being.
And so that's my next question. Take this for us and apply it to resurrection. So those who are familiar or committed to the more traditional point of view on resurrection, help us walk through a little bit about how this applies to your point of view on resurrection.
Okay. There is a belief that Jesus is the same as the biblical figure Enoch, or certainly had access to the same knowledge that the biblical figure Enoch had. Enoch was a pre-flood figure who was, like us, an esoteric researcher, a master of ancient legend and lore, specifically focused on this idea of transforming us into beings of light. The Archangel Michael appears to Enoch. Michael has an oil that he rubs on Enoch's body, and it instantly transforms Enoch into one of the glorious ones. He's shining. He's radiant. He's in his light body. And I equate this with the resurrection body, because when Christ is portrayed in glory, he is glowing rays. That's the meaning of the word glory. It means glow rays. You are glowing rays. And specifically, he is glowing rainbow-colored rays in Christian art. So based on this, I've asked the question, is it possible that Mary Magdalene's anointing oil is the same oil that Michael used to anoint Enoch, and this is the oil that transforms a mortal human into an angelic or a light being virtually on contact? And I believe that this is what's happening with Mary Magdalene, is that she possesses the secret of this oil. She anoints Jesus with it. It primarily works at the light body level. And the ultimate manifestation of this anointing is what we call the resurrection, when Jesus manifests as a being of light and then in Christian art is portrayed either sitting on a rainbow or enfolded within rainbow light.
So you feel that this anointing oil is an actual physical alchemical recipe. There is a physical type of oil that is used to make this process happen, as opposed to this is something that happens in the hands of masters and the oil is metaphorical.
That is a very good question, Kathleen. And the short answer is the one that I give in my presentation that takes a little bit to walk into. But the answer is, I believe it was a placebo. I don't believe there was an actual oil. I believe it's all belief. I believe it's all about expanding our consciousness. And that sounds like, well, then what's the point in looking into it? Well, the reason is you have to have the whole mindset, the background that makes it work. And this is just, it's maybe a strange conclusion, but this is where I'm going with this and recognizing that, especially today, the placebo effect is doubling right now. It's beating every single pharmaceutical that they can bring out. And I believe that what happened in the ancient world is that there was a power that Jesus transmitted to the disciples at the Last Supper. It was referred to as exousia, the cosmic power, the hidden power. And this exousia, this hidden power, this sacred power, is symbolized by a garment of light, and it's also symbolized by an oil. And as I'm looking at this, and I'm just kind of trying to go back in my imagination to the Last Supper, where Jesus beams or gifts or transmits this holy sacred power to the disciples, that the key component had to have been, A, they were prepared mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally for this experience, because if they weren't at a high enough vibration to receive this gift or this energy beaming from Jesus, it would have blown them right to smithereens probably. And two, I mean, they had to believe that this power was real. And by believing that it's real, and maybe with the introduction of some oil or a cream perhaps, that they could then kickstart this process within themselves.
Well, I think that there is a lot to that. And I think that, you know, the placebo effect actually is part and parcel to the idea of the power of ceremony. Whether mm-hmm. they're using, you know, Wesson yes. oil or spikenard, there is something important that's happening here in terms of the ritual. And we all know how powerful ceremony and ritual is for us spiritually and what it does for us. So I think that that really, you know, is the essence of it here, if you pardon the pun. I mean, did they utilize, oil? That would have been, you know, essential in their composition, i.e., spikenard or
cannabis,
something that was, you know, going to have an impact on the physical system as well. Of course, because they were masters, they would have known how to use all these things. But to your point, I think it's what they are transmitting is not about the oil at all. It's about this other process. So take me through your point of view on what happens to Mary Magdalene following the crucifixion.
Well, I follow the legend path, really, that she came to southern France, possibly to Rennes-le-Château. I'm very interested in particular in the ecstasy of Mary Magdalene and this legend, let's call it a legend, that she spent time in a cave, that angels would carry her into the heavens and they would feed her this star food or this divine food. And I as I study this artwork, once again, it dovetails with this whole concept of the oil, because what we'll see in these representations, we'll see the angels, we'll see the shaft of light that opens up, especially in Peter Paul Rubens' depiction of this. And what it seems to be indicating is that there once again was some kind of an essence or a substance that was used in France or known about in France that was used by Mary Magdalene that enabled her to connect with the divine realms.
So again, we're talking about something, a physical type of substance, as opposed to strictly her knowledge or a combination of the two. And is this where you pull in the ideas about mana?
This is where I pull in the ideas about mana. I'm fascinated by, I think it was Jean Mercure who talked about the Cathars utilizing a slightly different version of the Lord's Prayer, where they talk about the bread beyond substance, and wondering if are we talking about perhaps some kind of other dimensional substance? Are we talking about some otherworldly substance? Is this the same as the mana of the ancients? And if so, then we're challenged to go back to ancient Egypt, especially to Dendera, places like Edfu, the perfumery, where they were actually, I believe, manufacturing an actual manna-type substance.
So when we're talking about all of these subjects, William, we've been talking about Mary Magdalene, we've been talking about Rennes-le-Château, we have been talking about Cathars, we have been talking about Egypt. I'm going to throw one more subject into the fray, because this is something where you and Kathleen are going to talk about in 2 weeks from now. It is the Alchemy Conference, the International Alchemy Conference, actually, in Long Beach, California, from the 16th till the 18th of September, where both of you will be presenting on alchemy. So what is your opinion on alchemy? I'm pretty sure some of it you've already been touched upon, but just put it out there once again.
Well, I think of alchemy, of course, the two levels, it's about transformation. It's about taking an impure soul and turning it into a pure soul or a light being. And what I try to do in my alchemical studies is bring it into the body, because I believe that the body is not only the alchemical crucifix or crucible. I think the body is the temple, and taking that one step forward, I actually view the body as the stairway to heaven itself. It is the stargate. It is the wormhole that we see referenced in ancient depictions, and certainly modern physics talks about as well. But where I draw the line is that when you see representations of the stargate, as in movies like Contact and Stargate and some of the more popular representations of it, they seem fixed on this idea that the physical body can actually go through one of these gateways, whereas the research I've done in the ancient world, it always tells us that the physical body isn't going anywhere. There's an alchemical transmutation that occurs, that we are transformed into light beings, And it is as these light beings, as whole, holy, and complete beings, that we can then go through these gates. And that, to me, is the whole subject matter of alchemy. It's not, as in the popular imagination, so much about turning lead into gold. It's about making ourselves golden beings or shining beings.
So when we're looking at all of these beings, these shining ones, do you see something as happening right now? Do you believe that in ancient times these beings, we were transforming ourselves physically within this reality, or was it more something for the dead, or how do you see this happening?
Are you asking, do I think there are light beings today?
Yes, and in the past.
I do believe there are light beings today. I'm a big fan of a place called the East Seti Ranch up in southern Washington. I've been there a couple of times, and the reason I'm fascinated by it is because they've been documenting these extraordinary UFO sightings up there, many hundreds of them that they've got on videotape. And they show two classifications of beings that they believe appear up there. One are the hard technological craft, the kind of the shiny disc kind of things, the typical UFO. But then they've also got sightings of what they believe are these organic beings. And this gets me really excited, because when you go back into the Mahabharata, you go back into all the sacred traditions, they talk about this class of beings that might be humans that are referred to as the perfected ones. Even Jesus referred to himself as part of the race of the perfect light humans, the immovable race of the perfect light humans. And they're suggesting that there is a whole race of beings out there of transformed humans or perfected humans, humans who have gone through this alchemical process, if you will, perfected themselves and transformed themselves into these organic beings of light.
And so can we contact them? Do we know them as, I mean, when you're talking, what comes to mind is like angels.
Angels, yeah. In fact, I believe that these beings are actually seraphs. During the Renaissance, there was a huge resurgence in this ancient knowledge, and they made specific reference to the seraphs or seraphim and the possibility that through focusing on the divine love of the Creator and only the love of the Creator, that it would be possible for an ordinary human being to transform themselves into the level of the seraphs. The seraphs are considered the highest order of angels. They're beings of pure light, pure love. They dwell at God's throne, and they are portrayed as the six-winged angelic beings. But when you look into them more deeply, you realize that they're actually energetic beings. They're light beings. And in fact, Jesus manifested as a seraph to St. Francis when he beamed the wounds of the stigmata to St. Francis. And so it suggests to me that perhaps what we're dealing with here is these continual clues to the existence of a higher level of transformed humans who could well be the seraphs. And yes, you can call them into your life. And I believe I've actually had an experience with a seraph.
Well, that is actually leads me to my next question. As I'm hearing you talk about this, I'm thinking, I want to know about how this has affected you personally and spiritually, whatever you're willing to talk about. I realize that's a personal question, but then you gave me a great lead by saying you've had an experience, so now we have to know.
It starts with me, I guess. I had a heart chakra awakening in the Egyptian temples. I thought I was having a heart attack, actually, and it turned out it was a heart opening. And so now I would go through the temples, or I'd be in a museum, and I'd see, in particular, a piece of Egyptian statuary, and my heart chakra opens sort of like dowsing rods. It goes about 5 or 6 feet wide and just can engage the energy field of the temple or the statue. And it was actually back at the East Seti Ranch that I was pulsed by one of these light beings the first time that I was there. I'm standing out in the middle of a field at night, and these crazy lights are going on up above, and all of a sudden I feel this whoosh right through my heart chakra, and it actually I felt three of those whoosh kinds of things, and just felt definitively like, yeah, I've been kind of beamed by something. And then I was up there again a couple of years ago, and I was talking about the seraphs and this Renaissance belief that we could transform ourselves into seraphs. In fact, this could be the point of our whole existence. And I cited these examples of Jesus manifesting as a seraph to St. Francis. The word seraph means fiery serpent or winged serpent, which is exactly the same definition as Quetzalcoatl, the Mayan savior figure, who's expected to return in 2012, in some people's opinion. So I'm making this case that the seraphs have always been around us. They're the highest order of angels. They manifest as these orange, reddish-orange orbs in Christian art and elsewhere. They're, the fiery angels. And when you look at depictions of them, very often you will see them as these reddish-orange, fiery angels. So what happens is that after my talk, James Gilliland, the host, says, and at 9 o'clock tonight, we're going to open up a Stargate. And, of course, I start laughing, and everybody else starts laughing, too. It sounded so preposterous. But at 9 o'clock, sure enough, he did some kind of a ceremony. We walk outside of the lecture hall. There's 300 people there. There's about 30 of us that walk outside together, including James and I. We're standing there talking, admiring the night sky, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, drops this reddish-orange orb that floats over us for about 45 seconds. And, of course, you go through the whole checklist. It's not making any noise. It's not some kind of an aircraft. It's got to be some kind of a energetic phenomena that we're engaging, and the people that are standing out there going, oh my gosh, that's got to be a seraph, because it perfectly matched the description of what I had been showing earlier. I can't prove that it was a seraph, but I do have a video of that experience. Somebody was heady enough to get out their camera phone, and they videotaped the whole thing. And all I can tell you is that as you're listening and you're watching this, what you're really hearing are these incredible shrieks of joy. The excitement, the just pure bliss of engaging this orangish red orb was enough for me to go to weigh in on the side that I think we experienced one of these beings of high energy and high bliss.
And how has this heart opening affected your work? You're a Libra. You are a cardinal air sign. You come from a very cerebral point of view. A lot of your research is very cerebral. But on the other hand, there is a lot of spirit in your research as well. So I think one of the things I'm curious about is how you have felt yourself evolve spiritually in this process through these kinds of awakenings.
Well, the heart chakra opening for me opened up a real link or connection to not just the ancient Egyptian temples, but especially some of the artwork that I show, because I started to research this belief. It's actually kind of more of a science of the icon makers who believed that these icons that they created, especially the icons of transfiguration, when Jesus takes the disciples up to the top of the mountain and he reveals himself as a being of light, he transfigures or metamorphoses in front of the disciples. And there's some incredible icons that have been made of this experience that show Jesus on top of the mountain with this sort of star body. He's wearing his bright white garment of light, and he's always got this star, huge star behind him, or a ring filled with stars. And I take kind of a Forrest Gump approach to this artwork. If it looks like a stargate, in other words, if we're looking at a ring or a gate filled with stars, that could well be a stargate. And so what I'm suggesting is that in the transfiguration scenes, you've got Jesus in his bright white garment of light standing in front of this open gateway that's filled with stars that represents our connection with the divine realm. And the belief among the icon makers is that these images are not just pretty pictures. They are portals themselves. They are gateways. They are mirrors. And if you can connect mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally with what Jesus is experiencing in that transfiguration, your body already knows how to do this cocoon. What you need is the model, the butterfly, Jesus, in order to help us to accomplish this. But the problem is, you and I, or I'm saying you and I metaphorically, us, we, are sort of like those two caterpillars I saw in a cartoon once looking up at the butterfly saying, you'll never get me up in one of those things. and that's the fundamental problem. There's a gap. We don't believe that we can transfigure into beings of light. Therefore, we don't. But what this process has done for me is to say, all right, open up the heart, because this is where all the action happens. You've got to be able to feel the love. You've got to feel the deep divine love emanating from Jesus at this moment, because that's what the transfiguration is. It's an act of love. And if you can connect with that, your body will begin this process of lighting up in illumination and metamorphosis exactly the way Jesus is showing us how to do it.
That is absolutely beautiful. Really, really beautifully described. Thank you. Can we expect to hear more of this from you at the Alchemy Conference? What's going to be the theme of your presentation on September 17th, when we are together in Long Beach for the International Alchemy Conference? We'll be sharing the stage together that day, and I think each of us are giving a 90-minute presentation. What's yours going to be about?
Yeah, and by the way, I can't wait. That is a wonderful conference. This will be the second time I've appeared at this event. It's wonderfully run. They've got an incredible audience, very astute. It's a place where people come to do serious work, and I hope everybody listening will have a chance to visit with us there. But my topic will be these sacred icons and their power to transform us, to transfigure us. My presentation is based on my DVD set, Soul Rising, which is a term borrowed from the Transfiguration, because during that event, the disciples, of course, automatically go into fear. They're not, we're told they weren't prepared, conceptually perhaps, to see Jesus suddenly transform himself into a being of light. So they go into fear, and Jesus tells them, rise and do not be afraid. And this is the whole message of this art, is that we have to rise. We have to overcome fear. We have to get beyond the fear frequency, raise the vibration of our soul. And as we do that, this artwork is in fact the guide that will help us to do this. And what I encourage people to do in my presentation, can encourage people now, is to really begin to engage some of this artwork. I've got several examples of the Transfiguration artwork I'm speaking of in the gallery on my website. You can check that out. But get a copy of Soul Rising and start to look at this artwork and recognize, one, the intention that it was created with, and two, the amazing power that is encoded within this imagery, and recognize that its ultimate purpose is to enlighten and to awaken us.
I have not yet seen Soul Rising. It's a DVD series, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I will definitely check that out. But, you know, there's a lot of similarities, again, to something that I write about and we'll also be talking about at the conference, which is the power of the Renaissance artists and what these Renaissance masters were doing. And it's essentially, it's the same idea, taken into a different time frame and framework for the art, but that this art is divinely inspired, that these artists use a process which I refer to in my book, The Poet Prince, a process that they called infusion, and in that they allowed divine light to come through them while they were creating these extraordinary works of art. And certainly you have Botticelli and Michelangelo being probably the most well-known artists who are capable of doing this, although I think that you know, the real greats actually came from Flanders. It really starts with Jan van Eyck, and I don't know if you're going to be talking about the Mystic Lamb at all in your presentation. I will be a little bit, because I think that's such a powerful and important piece. But I think what a lot of people don't realize is that it was Cosimo de' Medici who basically imports the Flemish into Florence to teach these extraordinary processes of infusion and putting this divine essence into the art. So when you stand in front of these extraordinary pieces of work, you are actually experiencing the divine. You are having a divine experience. There is angelic presence in these paintings. I'm sure you're familiar with something called Stendhal syndrome, wherein people actually become crazy when they are in the presence of art, extraordinary art. And the most documented cases of Stendhal syndrome are in front of Botticelli. So there is something that happens in Botticelli's art that overwhelms people and causes almost a type of temporary insanity. People have even passed out in the Botticelli room in the Uffizi because the energy in there is so powerful. So I think we're talking about the same ideas, just translated into different kinds of art.
Yeah, it is so fascinating. I've had a very good friend for a number of years, 25 years or so, Dr. Mario Martinez. He's a Nashville psychologist who actually studied stigmatics for the Vatican. He went around the world studying stigmatics for the Vatican. And he demonstrated how a woman in California demonstrated the stigmata wounds after obsessively reading about the crucifixion. And this goes to this idea that where the mind goes, the biology follows. And so it doesn't surprise me. I mean, I cite examples in Soul Rising and Will in my Alchemy Conference of other figures. St. Catherine of Siena, for example, went into an ecstatic trance and received the stigmata wounds from a painting of the crucifixion. And all this goes to this idea of mirror neurons is a corollary to what you're describing to me, Kathleen. There's neurons in the front of our brain that were somehow mysteriously activated about 100,000 years ago. They are monkey-see-monkey-do neurons. In other words, the brain can't tell the difference between a real and an imagined experience. And they have proven there at UCLA that parts of the brain, the neurons, will fire when you watch a person receiving a shot. Your body responds as if it is you who is receiving that shot. These pain neurons will fire. And this is a function of the mirror neurons. And so this goes back to what the icon makers were saying, is that these paintings are mirrors. These are portals. They are gateways to the divine realm, but they're also mirrors. And as you stand in front of them and you engage them mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally, you are, a part of you is mirroring what you are seeing in this painting. And I think you can equally extend that to Botticelli. So when, for example, you're looking here at maybe, let's say, Pallas and the Centaur, and she's all suited up in her light body garment. She's got her diamond tips on. She's got her olive branch. She's got her transparent garment on. Maybe a part of us knows, hey, this is all symbolic of the light body. And maybe there's your energy body, your higher self, is getting all excited at seeing the symbolism so beautifully infused, as you're suggesting, or enfolded into this painting. And it just starts this process of excitement, and you're engaged in it.
And it becomes physically overwhelming.
And it becomes physically overwhelming because, again, where the mind goes, the biology follows. And if you're not quite prepared for it, it can be an overwhelming experience. But just think, if you are prepared for it, if you are prepared to tune into Pallas Athena and to engage her in this way, it's an extraordinary experience. We have a scale replica of the Parthenon here in Nashville where I live. I live right beside it, actually, and I take people over there all the time. And inside is the tallest indoor statue in the Western world. It's a 42-foot tall statue of Pallas Athena. She's completely covered in gold. And I got to tell you, I've witnessed people have extraordinary experiences with this statue because they just engage in it and they receive sort of a hit from it. It's the only way I can describe it.
It's very interesting. And what you're describing is this technology, this spiritual technology as to how people can transform themselves into something otherworldly. And now you're a regular on Ancient Aliens, the popular History Channel series. One of the questions I always get is, okay, where does this leave the concept of God if there have been ancient aliens and somehow we have misunderstood them for God? Where does this leave God? You're a very spiritual person. Obviously, you have been talking about technology. How do you see the two match? And kind of like putting another question behind and on top of that is, where do you see the spiritual technology coming from? Because clearly you have identified periods and you've gone as far back as Egypt. But should we go further back into history to find the beginning of this spiritual technology?
Well, that's a wonderful question, Philip. And I go back to the kind of the core of this, where I sort of departed. I mentioned Zachariah Sitchin earlier. There are those that subscribe to his theory that the Anunnaki, the ancient gods, ancient aliens, came to Earth 450,000 years ago. And as the Atrahasis suggests, they created they use the term slave race these days, but they created a race of beings that could do the work for humans. And then somewhere along the line, it came into this theory that they were here for gold. And I haven't found the exact reference in the original Sumerian tablets where they said the gods are here for gold in order to repair their decaying atmosphere of their home planet. I don't see that anywhere. I think that's Sitchin's overlay. And as I was looking at that, I'm thinking, okay, this is really fascinating because the god that was supposed to have created humanity or fashioned our bodies was named Enki. The Egyptians called him Ptah, of course. And the theory is that they created our body as a slave race in order to mine this gold. Well, Enki, like Ptah, is considered to be a god of alchemy as well. And the question that entered into my mind is, well, why does a god of alchemy need to come here to this remote planet to mine gold? why doesn't he just grab a hunk of space rock and transmute it, or go find some supernova that's recently exploded and grab it, or something along those lines? It seems like it was a real elaborate thing to come here and violate, if there is a prime directive, to violate the prime directive and create a slave race. So that didn't make sense to me. But then what did begin to make sense is that in alchemical terminology, the terms gold and soul, as in human soul, are interchangeable. The whole backstory of the Anunnaki coming here was that there was a planetary cataclysm and their home planet had been destroyed, or a planet had been destroyed, and the Earth was one of the surviving remnants of this cataclysm. That in mind, I wondered, is it possible that there were souls on that planet that were left embedded in this planet, this protoplanet that became Earth? And if so, is it possible that the gods came here originally not on a gold mining mission, like there's some galactic gold mining company, but rather to rescue or, quote-unquote, save the souls from this former cataclysm? And the way that they did that was the human body as a soul rescue device, because from the soul's perspective, the human body is considered to be the ladder, tower, or stairway to heaven. So this is how I start to mix the spiritual aspect with the ancient alien theory, and it just takes me in a slightly different direction than some of the other theorists who maintain that the gods weren't really here for spiritual purposes, and that they are maybe a lower level of spiritual evolution than perhaps we give them credit for.
Absolutely, and I definitely believe that one of the identifications, if you want, of the ancient aliens was precisely that they were teaching us sciences, but also spiritual sciences, as you were saying, knowledge of the soul. And one of the greatest written down texts about this, I always think, is the Corpus Hermeticum, whereby it is said how the angels have placed on earth this cup where, if we so choose to, can drink from, so that we will transform into the creatures we are meant to be in the lifetime, and to use wording which Kathleen has used in her novels as well, to remember why we are here for. And that is really something I think which is moving an awful lot of people these days. People are searching a lot for basically a spirit revolution. And as Kathleen has been saying, you've been involved in this field. You were there when the Egyptian revolution happened, which basically was a bright spark in the Arab countries, a cry for change. Where do you see man, Western man, and the world as a whole at this moment in time, and what are its challenges to really either continue on the path of a spirit revolution or to bring a spirit revolution about?
Well, I feel that we have less than 30 years to bring about a true spiritual revolution. I believe there's a clock that's ticking, and the clock that's ticking is the technology clock. 2045 is the year people like Ray Kurzweil and other technologists believe that mankind becomes immortal. What this means is that's by then we're all going to be robots. By then we're going to have these millimeter-sized chips implanted in our eye. They've got these fancy new tattoo computers that are going to be implanted in human skin that's supposed to make computer gaming and spy operations even better or easier than in the past. What we're doing is we're turning ourselves into cyborgs, and I'm not convinced that is the way we want to go. I believe that we want to avoid that path and instead use the next 30 years to really focus on developing ourselves spiritually, to gather as much as we can about the light body effect, as I call it. The Tibetans call it the rainbow body. The Christians call it the resurrection body. We're told that we can achieve this in one lifetime, and I believe that we have very limited time right now to be able to actually make that happen.
So where do you see the things happening in the world? Because there are sparks, some of them which keep trying to be to remain alive in the Arab world. As I said, there are other events happening in the Western world whereby people are beginning to realize that this straightforward materialistic world is being tied into the money cycle. This extreme hype about the financial crises, all of this news which is bombarded to us via television screens on a daily basis, isn't the real reality, that somehow this is a reality which is imposed on us and which to some extent doesn't slave us and keeps us in the materialistic world. And as you say, kind of like, you know, doesn't give us enough time to actually realize that we can do certain things purely of the mind and focus on the real things that matter, like love. So where do you see hopes or points of hope, really, for the future?
Well, this is, let's talk about, we're coming up here on the anniversary of 9/11, which was a huge multifaceted moment, lightning strike moment in modern human history that took us into, in some people's opinion, many people's opinion, quite a dark path. It culminated in the launching of the war on terror and trillions of dollars being spent on war when it could be spent on peace. My point is that maybe there's going to be another kind of lightning strike moment. I believe that humankind is capable of calling in these extraordinary moments as opportunities for us to wake up. I mean, remember what the world was like in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. It was perhaps the most peaceful time of all. The world was united. There was tremendous goodwill all around the planet. Maybe we're calling in the process right now of calling in some high magnitude kind of event, maybe cataclysmic earth changes, maybe some kind of manifestation of otherworldly beings, some kind of disclosure kind of moment. These are kind of wild card things that I can't point to one specifically that is going to happen. But as I look around Facebook, as I look around and listen to radio interviews and that, people are terrified. They are absolutely on the edge right now, and this is the time when we're going to either go deeper into ourselves and catch the glimmer of our deepest and highest self, or we're going to succumb to the fear and we're just going to go right off the cliff.
And with that, we have to also go off the cliff, unfortunately, for this edition of The Spirit Revolution. William, it's been fantastic having you on. We will see you physically, and if you want to see William, Kathleen, and myself in the physical form, we will try to transform ourselves in a shining one at this very conference, but we will definitely probably start out in the physical realm. This is the Alchemy Conference in Long Beach, California. September 16th through to the 18th, Kathleen and William's presentation are on the 17th, and you can see them presenting there on the subject of alchemy. William's website is williamhenry.net. You will also be able to find information there about his various books and his various radio shows. If you want to hear this radio show again, you can do so in a number of formats. You can go to the BBS Radio Archives. You will need to pay a small fee for that. However, you do not need to pay a fee if you want to download the podcast from iTunes, where more than a year of archives are available. And you can also listen to the five last episodes of The Spirit Revolution on our own website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. We will be back next week, but until that time,
the truth against the world.